Good evening, everyone. So this Saturday, this last Saturday, we had a one-day retreat with Kokio Henkel, and he was teaching on the subject of the illusion of the separate self. So this teaching is the teaching of Anatta, or the teaching of no self, a very central and perhaps definitive teaching of Buddhism, a definitive and unique teaching of Buddhism, but not also unknown in the Western world, but announced, 2,500 years ago by the Buddha. This teaching is that there is no permanent, unitary, independent self. And that to think so, to have the belief in such a enduring permanent essence to anything, whether ourselves or anything that we would encounter in this universe, is an erroneous view. This is an erroneous view. And the Buddha taught this, gave this teaching, not only to correct our erroneous views of that there's some me, I, mine here. So he did teach it to correct this erroneous view, but he also taught this out of compassion for particularly us human beings. Belief in a separate self is the source of a great deal of difficulty for people, and it is the source of fear, is a source of worry, is a source of envy, it is a source of jealousy. And perhaps most tragically, it is the source of violence against others and against the self. So this teaching is not, it is actually a lofty philosophical teaching, but it is also a teaching of great compassion. That we discover how to relate to ourselves as not the center of everything, not the center even of our own experience, or what appears as our own experience. As Kokio taught Saturday, Buddha's teaching first, I was going to use the word attacked, but that doesn't sound right, addressed. The Buddha's teaching first addressed the issue of the unitariness of the self. And so in describing the self, the Buddha taught the five skandhas, which we just mentioned in the Heart Sutra: form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. And that's the teaching that the self, what we call a self, is not in fact unitary. but is a composed and fabricated and made up agglomeration or aggregation of these five factors. But then, of course, the Buddha didn't want us to get hung up on these five and substitute them for something that would be unitary, or, well, not unitary, it wouldn't be unitary, but it would be permanent and independent, potentially. You could think of them that way. So rather than teach that, of course, the Buddha taught that these five are empty. They have these five, neither do, just as the idea of a unitary self is empty, so are these five skandhas. They have no essence. They have no independent existence. But again, this is not just a high-minded idea. This is a teaching of great compassion. And always, you know, when you hear this teaching, I think it's important to remember that the belief in a separate self is the source of ill. And so it should, you know, it's meant to encourage us to examine our experience just as the Buddha intended, as not unitary, as not independent, as not permanent. It's meant to teach us how to be unmoored in a way to any fixed place, any fixed part of our ideas or emotional life or anything, to teach us to let go, as we say. And so the teaching, I just like to read the teaching as it appears in the original one of this teaching appears all over the place, but it is just one example of how this teaching appears in the early scriptures. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, and it's put this way. Of that which is impermanent and subject to suffering and change, one cannot rightly say, this belongs to me, this I am, this is self. Therefore, whatever there be of body, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, those five skandhas that I mentioned, whether one's own or external, whether gross or subtle, lofty or low, far or near, one should understand according to reality and true wisdom, and I would add, and compassion, this does not belong to me. This I am not. This is not self. So this is how, you know, you could almost, you know, use that, those words in, as things arise in your zazen, right? As things come up, as thoughts, feelings, perceptions come up in zazen, you could think, this does not belong to me. This I am not. This is not self. And this is a way to, this is kind of a vipassana practice in our zazen that we could do to understand as things arise that they are not self. They're just things that are arising. This, you know, that they're just coming and they're just going. They're not who we are. So, and this, I mentioned earlier that this idea of not self is not unknown in Western philosophy, or teachings of compassion, but it's also found it's found there. And a quote that I've known for a long time is from David Hume in his treatise on human nature. And it goes like this. For my part, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. I never catch myself at any time without a perception and never can observe anything but the perception. So this is a philosopher closely examining his experience as non-unitary, as just the arising of phenomena, and nothing else. There's always just this perception, this perception, this perception, over and over again, but nothing. He can't find any unitary permanent thing that's having the perception. There's no center to this perception. There's just perception. Perception, perception, perception. So this is, I think it's, this is both a challenging and a difficult, you know, but also useful approach to our life and to our Zen practice. But we have to do it. We have to make this approach in the midst of the five skandhas. We don't get outside the five skandhas in order to do this work. We are always in the midst of the five skandhas. Just right now, well, there's five skandhas, right? So the first one is form, which is, as Kokyo pointed out, is generally understood as my body and the bodies of other people and the bodies of window shades and zabutons and zafus. So anyway, it's the form of everything, the body of everything, and in order to discover, we have to discover the emptiness of form in the midst of form, because there we are always right there, we're always in the midst of form. As long as we're alive. And similarly, we are always in the midst of feeling. So feeling is in this sense, which is also called sensation, is either a good, not good, or neutral. So you're sitting there, and you're in the midst, always in the midst of that kind of feeling. I like what he's saying. I don't like what he's saying. I'm neutral. I can live with what he's saying, but I don't like it or not like it. So there's always some undertone of feeling. We're always in the midst of these five skandhas. And so practice is letting go of them while we're in the midst. While we're in the midst of them, yet we let go of them over and over and over again. So Kokyo brought up this term, which I've heard before, but I hadn't heard for a while. Upadana Pancha Skanda, which means, Upadana means attachment or clinging. Pancha means five, and this is Sanskrit. Upadana, so attachment, five skandhas. This is the situation that we find ourselves in, attachment, five skandhas. And this is the situation that we vow or aspire to free ourselves from, or free ourselves within. So the skandhas are, as I say, always operating, but in the midst of their operation, we're encouraged not to see an operator. There's nobody operating these five skandhas. There's the operation. The operation is always going on, but there's no operator here. And that understanding we can take right into our zazen, right into our zazen, and work with it. Work with it. You could even debate with it. You know, you could argue with it, but entertain that understanding. I encourage that. Entertain that understanding in the midst of arising of many phenomena, that there is no operator bringing these, you know, there's no dealer bringing these phenomena forward, these five skandhas forward. They're coming forward all the time. They are who we are, but there's no operator. And if you keep that, you know, foremost in your consciousness, if you try to bring that into your consciousness, then this is the really the practice of non-attachment. This is the practice of non-attachment, of not seeing a self, a unitary permanent entity driving the bus. The bus is being driven, no doubt about it, but there's really no driver. It's a driverless bus. We're getting those, right? Cars and so forth. So I'm going to now. That was an attempt to kind of summarize what Kokyo talked about for 2 hours on Saturday. Of course, this is highly compressed, what I've just said, but I did advertise this as you know, a Dharma discussion. So, but I want to take this one further step that you know, maybe wasn't so well, so much brought out on Saturday, and it has. And the reason it's not because Kokyo left anything out. It was a wonderful presentation. So it's not because he left anything out. It's just because I've been studying another teacher who has what should we say, like a further elaboration or extension of the teaching of no self, or maybe it's better to say a different understanding of actually of self, of what could be conceived of as a self. And this is an interesting phenomena, as you know, those of you who've you know, done a little bit of study, for instance, in Dogen and other later teachers, you see this, the word self come back into the discussion quite a bit. At least the word self comes back quite a bit. So this teacher that I've been studying brings this word back, this word self back, in an interesting way. And this teacher, his name is Menzon, and he was Japanese in the 18th century, and he was a reviver of Dogen's teaching. So he was some 4 or 5 centuries removed from Dogen, but who was in the 13th century, but as it turned out, Dogen's teaching had fallen into, you know, somewhat fallen out of in people's knowledge. You know, it had been kind of lost. It was luckily not lost, but it wasn't being studied. It wasn't being commented on for about 400 or 500 years. And Menzon was a great reviver and of Dogen's teaching, and he wrote extensively. So I took a course to learn about this teacher with Sho Haku Okamura recently. And what Menzon talks about is what he calls the radiant light of the self. The radiant light of the self. And this this idea of radiant light comes actually comes a lot out of the Avatamsaka Sutra, which basically presents a vision that the Buddha's enlightenment sent out a great light, not only through this world, but through many world systems throughout the universe, countless in number. And that this light, has never been extinguished, and it's still radiating and reflecting off of everything. So you could say, well, this is a very mystical teaching. We could say that. But this is the teaching. This is the teaching that from the Avatamsaka Sutra, the main Buddha in that sutra is called Vairochana, or the Dharmakaya Buddha, the Buddha of the entire universe. So this is the Buddha as a cosmic principle. And his main activity is, or her main activity is, radiating this great light throughout the universe. And that light is still being reflected off of everything, still being received and it's still lighting up everything. Excuse me. And it's still reflecting everything. Excuse me. So I'll just I wasn't going to read Menzon, but then I read this. I had written down quite a few from his. He has this text called Jiyu Zamai, which means it's the same word as the self-perceiving samadhi. This kind of encapsulates the view that Menzon offers throughout this text. And this is really practical Zazen instruction, as you'll hear. Only when we sit Zazen in our daily lives are our eyes open to the reality outside of the domain of thoughts and discrimination. We just illuminate our thoughts that moment by moment come up and pass away, refraining from fabricating adoption or rejection, hatred or love. As with the Tathagata, what we do in our zazen is expressed as emitting the great radiant light, illuminating the 10 direction world, and enabling all sentient beings to attain a liberation. To attain liberation. So that last line is the one that you should hear of being as with the Tathagata, as with Vairochana, emitting this great light of, you know, enlightenment. His enlightenment is literally emitting a great light in this world. So Minzan says, as with the Tathagata, what we do in our zazen is expressed as emitting the great radiant light, illuminating the 10 direction world, and enabling all sentient beings to attain liberation. So, you know, if that vision is too big, there's also just in zazen, letting this light of awareness illuminate your own experience, illuminate the five skandhas. The idea is this light I had a word, but I don't know what it is. I can't remember the word, but this light is inherent, something like that. That's not quite right, because inherent's not a great word. But this light is reflecting off of you as much as it's a reflecting off of everything else. And so, you know, it's similar in vision to the Indra's net. And you've heard about the Indra's net, which is a net of many jewels, which are each reflecting one another. Each jewel sees all the other jewels. The light of all the other jewels is reflected in each jewel. And the light of this jewel is reflected in all the other jewels. So it has that kind of feeling too. It's similar to that kind of feeling and you could think that this light is the light also, if you want a more kind of down to earth vision of it, is the light of enlightened, non-discriminating consciousness. So there's discriminating consciousness, which is the consciousness of the five skandhas. That's discriminating consciousness. That's part of our setup, as it were. But there's also there's also the Buddha's light. There's also the, according to this, our teaching, this Buddha's light, which has been radiating for 2,500 years, or in case of Vairochana, who knows, you know, throughout cosmic time. But this idea, this teaching of the radiant light is found. You probably heard it through many other sutras, and it's found in Dogen, and you probably heard it in the self-receiving and employing samadhi, which says, grass, trees, and lands, which are embraced by this teaching, by the Buddha's teaching, together radiate a great light and endlessly expound the inconceivable profound Dharma. Grass, trees, and walls bring forth the teaching for all beings, common people as well as sages, and they in accord extend this Dharma for the sake of grass, trees, and walls. Thus the realm of self-awakening and awakening others invariably holds the mark of realization with nothing lacking, and realization itself is manifested without ceasing for a moment. So the work of bodhisattvas is to realize that ultimately we live in the midst of this light, and we are receiving it and we are giving it away all the time. We're reflecting it all the time. It's kind of a lot of responsibility in a way, you know, to receive this, to live in the awareness that we are receiving, we are fully receiving the light of the Buddha. But in another way, it's not really any responsibility, because whatever we're doing, we're reflecting this light. It's just a process of do we understand? Well, this is a very expansive, so Menzon calls this the radiant light of the self. So this is a very different and expansive idea of self that is not singular, independent, or permanent. It's eternal. It's an eternal light that has been emitted into this universe, that has been radiated into this universe, and is still reflecting off of everything. Our joy is, you know, to continually practice in the knowledge that we are included in this light and have an opportunity to and will, whatever we do anyway, radiate this light through all world systems. And especially, you know, to the people that we are close to and live with and speak with, you know, we have that opportunity to have that kind of vision of the self that is not constricted to, five skandhas. It is not limited to five skandhas. But it begins, you know, I will say, just to bring this back down, it begins, this process begins with studying the self and studying our attachment to the five skandhas, studying Upadana Pancha Skandha, attachment, clinging to five skandhas. Our life as a practitioner begins with that kind of study. And then, you know, gradually we can open up more to, you know, this wider vision of the radiant light of the self. Maybe we'll open up to that eventually. So I've said quite a bit. It's not really so much of a Dharma discussion at this point. It's kind of a Dharma monologue. But Clem is about to launch us into a Dharma discussion. Thank you, Clem.
I hope so.
Here comes your microphone.
Yes, early on in your discussion, I found the notion of action without an actor to be problematic. But then I don't ascribe an actor to the wind. And it occurs to me that such a view has certain advantages. Like, for example, if someone cares to offer me offense, there's no one to be offended, nor is there anyone to seek retribution against. So this may be a key to social harmony.
Thank you for that observation. There's no self in the wind.
At least not that I'm aware of.
That was very nice, teacher. So when you were just speaking of that, what comes to my mind because of my love of the ocean is a wave. And there's always a drive or a wave, but what makes it move? Is it the wind? Is it the air? Is it like what makes it? It's none of those things, but yet it's all of those things. It's profound what you mentioned. Makes you really wonder. And it's a hard one to really grasp when you're just getting started. But very, very good. Thank you.
Well, you hit an analogy that's often used in particularly the Lankavatara Sutra, the image of waves in the ocean. But actually in that sutra, those waves are more problematic. They're blown by the winds of externality. And they can kind of create some problems for us. The encouragement is to sink beneath the waves where it's calm, where there's not so much activity. And we go down in that ocean and where things aren't being blown by the winds of externality, and it's calm. And that's where the Buddhas live, apparently.
When you were talking about, no driver, no self, I thought, well, what about intention or what about decisions? But I guess those are then considered thoughts. Is that right? I mean, is that what?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Intention and thought are like synonyms for one another in Buddhism.
Yeah. So. But still, somebody is choosing that thought over that other thought.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I understand that there's no permanent fixed self, but I think I still think that there is some kind of flowing self, you know, that's always changing, but it's not fixed. So I don't know.
Well, the first part of your question, I think I have an image that came up about that, and that to me, it's like, okay, so you know about intention, you know, and like everybody has to make decisions, right? Everybody has to figure things out and decide things, and it certainly seems like that's an activity of the self, or we could view it that way. But if you ever had the experience of and I think everybody has, that you have some problem that you're trying to figure out and trying to make a decision, and then you're doing something else, and all of a sudden, this occurs to me often when I'm swimming. Swimming is for me, what happens is the answer comes, but I didn't decide it. There was just clarity all of a sudden. There was clarity. So, you know, intention is, you know, there's such a thing in terms of I've got to decide something or I've got to move in a certain way or do something. But where that does the clarity come from, a self or not? Oftentimes we think, That clarity did not come from us. It didn't come from my deliberate activity. It just seemed to come from elsewhere. Of course, you know, many scientists and so forth, they work on problems, and there's been many stories of, like, the answer just came all at once in a big rush, and it was complete. The answer was completely there, right there, you know, all at once. There wasn't a step by step. There had been steps, but when the clarity came, it was all at once. So, you know, there's more going on than, what's that thing from Shakespeare? Anyway.
There's more to heaven and earth than is found in earth.
Philosophy, Horatio, that's it. There's more to heaven and earth. There's more to heaven and earth than is found in your philosophy. And in your deliberations.
Maybe it's something like right and left, what we call sometimes right and left brain.
You could call it that.
Also, you could just call it the life force or the radiance or something.
Oh, the radiant light of the self. Yeah, you could call it the radiant light of the self if you took Menzon's, you know, term.
Yeah.
Clem, did you have something else?
This talk about intention made me wonder, is there ever intention that does not arise from desire? And taking that to its dismal conclusion, is greed, hate, and delusion at the root of our existence?
A close, certainly the five skandhas and greed, hate, and delusion, kind of do walk hand in hand. There's no doubt about that. But there is going, you know, in our teaching, there is going beyond the five skandhas, and there's going beyond greed, hate, and delusion. That's an established principle in the Buddha Dharma, in the Buddha's discourse, as they say. So there is going beyond the five skandhas, and there is, you know, although I will say, Myo says, you know, there's nothing but the five skandhas. True, but I still submit there is going beyond the five skandhas. Not to something exactly, but beyond any idea that there is an operator, you know, there's the man behind the curtain doing everything. And I think we get, you know, insight and solutions arising out of nowhere are kind of evidence of that, I think. Does that get at it, or just go around it?
It's a valiant attempt.
So, kind of riffing off of what Clem was saying about intention, isn't one of the spokes of the Eightfold Path right intention? And could you share with us specifically, or even more generally, what the Buddha meant by that, if that fits into this conversation?
The other translation of right intention is right thought, and what the Buddha, according to the teaching, meant is four things, and I don't know if I can really do them justice, but if a wholesome thought arises, continue it. If a wholesome thought has yet to arise, this is not right. But anyway, it's something like this. It's sort of like, and if a wholesome thought has arisen, encourage it. If an unwholesome thought has arisen, then, you know, cut it off. And anyway, it has to do with, I have the hardest time with this. I've read it a million times. But in any case, it's about wholesome thoughts and unwholesome thoughts, that what to do in the midst of wholesome and unwholesome thoughts. You don't continue unwholesome thoughts that have already arisen. But the best thing is not letting unwholesome thoughts arise in the first place. And you continue wholesome thoughts that are arisen, and you encourage wholesome thoughts to arise. Something like that. So that is right intention. It is, and you can go back and look it up on the internet and get a better definition than I've just supplied. But that is the formal definition of right intention, is to encourage wholesome thoughts and to discourage or cut off unwholesome thoughts. So it's really related to that right thought or right intention. You're into wholesomeness and you're not into unwholesomeness.
Thank you.
Another question?
Mm-hmm. Is that intention wholesome and unwholesome?
I'm so sorry. So is that wholesome and unwholesome, is that the intention? The intention could be a wholesome intent or an unwholesome intent that could turn into a negative action. Is that what that is? I'm trying to understand it.
I'm trying to understand your question.
Well, because you said intent is, you know, a wholesome thought or an unwholesome thought. So is that saying that your intent would be good intent, or that if you're going into an unwholesome, you would go into a poor or bad intent?
Well, right intention is wholesome. Is that, and not so right intention is unwholesome. So there's a bias in right intention toward wholesomeness. And there's a direction of letting go of unwholesome and turning away from unwholesome toward wholesome. So that's in right intention. Yes.
So I'm thinking about what you're offering to us about right intention, and what comes to mind is how ethics would probably support us in being able to turn towards the wholesome thought, or at least create more space for those wholesome thoughts to arise, because we're not constantly having to grapple with the consequences of our unskillful behavior. What do you think about that?
Good.
Yeah, love it.
Any news from the Zoom? I see some people. There's Tony.
I'll say something real quick. Hello, everyone.
Hi, Tony.
I'm sure glad I missed driving to Little Tokyo tonight to hear this talk and see some familiar faces. You know, I feel like I am on this no self kick lately. Just reading a lot of Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu, but you said something of like a violent act, like there's like towards the self, or to others or the self, right? That's this attachment to self is, you know, one, it's a cause of ill and suffering, which I understand very much so. But I don't think I've heard it in that sense, or maybe the word violent kind of like just like radiated this to me or something. It just opened up a lot for the, not, it's like not seriousness, but it kind of is, I guess, like, right? Like the suffering, that the attachment is so direct and so cunning, I feel like, and so just kind of the core of everything, that there is a seriousness to it. And so I guess just you saying there's this, the cause of a violent act between that can cause for others or ourselves, right? And then the teaching and the practice of not attaching or working to let loose, right, from this grip on us, like a fixed self, that being the compassionate act, right? The opposite of this violent encounter, because I feel like that resonates so well with me and just my life, and like people I know and everything I see. And I feel like it put that way into the world in which I believe that I live in, right, in my everyday. I don't know, that just really, there's some clarity, just, you know, some clarity arisen. So thank you.
Yes, I think self-clinging as a source of ill is indisputable. And productive of potentially at the worst, yes, violence. And that can be, it can be clinging to views, it can be clinging to identity, it could be clinging to someone who's insulted us, you know, insulted us, or as Kokyo brought up, falsely accused us, you know, that all of those could be sources of violence. So to free oneself from self-clinging is kind of an emergency operation. You know, we should practice this. As Dogen says, we should practice suchness without delay. So we should practice freedom from self-clinging without delay. And we should practice, because, you know, if somebody insults you, like, you just say, wow, that really hurt. That really was insult. That really hurt me. That really went to the core. Man, that hurt. And someone falsely accused, you might feel the same way. Wounded, you know, you might feel really wounded. But that's what to express. Express your woundedness, you know, and don't retaliate. And the greatest, you know, figures in our history taught this way of nonviolence. Okay, we better maybe make this the last question.
Thank you, Jim, for that recap. It was really brought back so many things of the teaching from Saturday. One of the lovely things was a conversation that four of us had during the at the break at noon, and we were talking about the importance of language and how we use language around this
internalizing this reality that there's no abiding self. And like we were just saying, instead of I'm feeling anger or I'm feeling wounded, there is anger here. There is a wound here. Instead of using the I. And I think Valerie said it so beautifully when she was talking about how, you know, she has chronic pain and she was thinking about leaving at the second half of the retreat until she shifted the perspective and said, there is pain here. Not I have pain or I am feeling pain and I need to leave because I'm in pain, but I'm sitting here and there is pain. Or I'm looking at this person and there is hurt that just happened. And I think that's really, for me, I was thinking that's a really powerful practice to break down that self. And also it diffuses everything because no longer I'm angry, but there's anger here, you know, and that sort of shifts the focus. So what do we do with the anger that's here instead of, you know, giving somebody an uppercut or screaming or yelling or feeling, you know, in hurt. It's like there is hurt. So that was a really good sequela and I think practical way to deal with this teaching.
I just was talking to my teacher yesterday and, he said it's not till the eighth stage of the Bodhisattva path that one never... It's only when you reach that stage does one never fall backwards. Does one never, at that stage, it's quite an advanced stage, you know, that's the time when one never falls backwards. So, you know, we're not always going to be exemplars of Sarah's teaching there, but that's the teaching. But when that time comes, when we fall backwards, then we have to be kind and compassionate to the situation then too. So it's not a, it's even though they say this is a straight path, I think it's kind of crooked. but nevertheless, you know, we can imagine it going straight ahead. Thank you very much.